From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, setting up a neutral hospital in a war-torn country. We welcome back one of the world's foremost war surgeons, Chris Yanu. He's just returned from stints in Burundi and Afghanistan with the International Red Cross. Before Yanu arrived in Burundi, there were several massacres at the hospital. Also today, the Bobbitts, Tanya Harding, Michael Jackson. Scandals are making it big even in the mainstream press. We'll talk to the producer of a new Frontline documentary about the tabloid press and its influence on mainstream media. The documentary follows how the press followed the Michael Jackson scandal. And classical music critic Lord Schwartz reviews a new recording of Yo-Yo Ma performing the work of American composers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The State Department says NATO allies have approved a plan to use airstrikes against Bosnian Serbs if they fire on Sarajevo. But the Serbs, apparently seeking to head off an attack, arranged a quick ceasefire with the United Nations. They say they'll pull their artillery from around the besieged city, too. President Clinton says he's pleased by the decision.
I think it's a good thing that they have a good beginning, but it shows, again, every time NATO shows a little resolve there, we get some results.
Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell says Congress will support the president in a coordinated effort with other NATO allies.
I have been in several meetings with the president and members of Congress on the subject of Bosnia. Without exception, every single member of the Senate and House who spoke to the president in my presence, Democrat and Republican, although offering very different views on what should be done, every one of them said it must be multilateral.
Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell. Democratic congressional leaders are promoting the president's health plan in Congress. Several of them met Mr. Clinton this morning to plan strategy for the campaign. The Congressional Budget Office says the health reform package will increase the deficit $126 billion between 1995 and 2004. Republican congressional leaders say that makes the plan too expensive. But the Democrats point out the CBO also says the medical plan covers all Americans and cuts medical bills in the long run. Residents of six Mexican towns have seized their municipal palaces. NPR's David Wellner reports the action appears to be a widening of social strife in southern Mexico.
Five of the six municipalities being held by townspeople are here in Chiapas. This is the same state where armed rebels briefly seized eight other towns on New Year's Day. But the occupation of the town halls appears to have been carried out entirely by civilians, demanding that the mayors be removed for alleged corruption. The mayors are all members of the PRI party, which has ruled Mexico for more than six decades. Yesterday, Mexican President Carlos Salinas met with 13 other PRI mayors from Chiapas and promised them greater federal support, but the civic revolts are expected to spread to other towns here and possibly to other states. Yesterday, residents of a town near Acapulco also seized their city hall. Government negotiators, meanwhile, say face-to-face talks with the Zapatistas will start sometime this week. I'm David Walnut in San Cristobal, Chiapas.
Reports from Cairo indicate the Israelis and Palestinians are close to a new agreement on Palestinian autonomy. An aide to PLO chairman Yasser Arafat says a formal announcement is expected shortly. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 25 points at 3,931. This is NPR. The chief of the Bureau of Indian Affairs is creating an internal affairs unit to look into charges of brutality that have been filed against agency federal officers. Assistant Interior Secretary Ada Deer set up the unit in December. It will have at least three staffers. Previously, regular BIA officers have investigated charges lodged against their colleagues. They decide if a complaint will be referred to the FBI for more investigation. Several tribal officials have complained that FBI agents almost always side with BIA officers accused of brutality and often don't announce when a case has been closed. The Oscar nominations are out. The Steven Spielberg film about the Holocaust is leading film awards with 12 nominations. Steve Proffitt reports.
Schindler's List will compete for Best Picture and offers director Steven Spielberg a chance to win his first Oscar as Best Director. two period films, The Piano and The Remains of the Day, each won 8 nominations. Both films have a shot at Best Picture, and the actresses in those films, Holly Hunter and Emma Thompson, were nominated for Best Actress. They were also nominated for Best Supporting Actress, Hunter for The Firm and Thompson for In the Name of the Father. That's the first time the same two actresses have shown up in both acting categories. And Jane Campion, director of The Piano, becomes only the second woman ever to receive a nomination for Best Director. The awards will be handed out in a televised ceremony on March 21st. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Proffitt in Los Angeles.
Nearly 120,000 German engineering workers are off the job. The IG Metall union warns it will begin a full strike if their demands aren't met. The union wants a 6% pay increase, but it says it'll take a pay cut if firms agree to a shorter work week. The companies insist employees will have to work longer hours. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Chris Yanu, is one of the world's most respected war surgeons. He works for the International Committee of the Red Cross in war-torn countries that are short on medical professionals. He's just returned from Burundi, one of the smallest nations in Africa, one of the poorest in the world, and one with among the highest mortality rates from ethnic fighting. Last year, after free elections were held, the president was assassinated in a coup. A series of massacres and counter-massacres followed between the country's two major ethnic groups, the Tutsis and the Hutus. Dr. Yanu spent most of last year in Afghanistan. Before that, he was chief of surgery for the Red Cross in Somalia. From 1985 to 87, he was the only surgeon in the Palestinian refugee camp Shatila in West Beirut, which was the subject of his book Besieged and the subject of our previous interview. Dr. Yanu's mission in Burundi was not only to care for the wounded, but to turn the hospital into a safe place.
In Burundi, one of the major problems was simply protection. There was a missionary hospital in the center of the country, and there had been a number of massacres in the hospital itself. A number of patients and personnel had been killed during the conflict. The Red Cross sent in a surgical team whose simple presence in the hospital, raising the Red Cross flag, helped in assuring a certain amount of stability and in protecting both personnel and patients. Over the next couple of months, till about January of this year, I headed that surgical team, and as well as our protection function and mandate, we operated on the wounded of that conflict.
Well, you were there in part to provide some protection for the hospital by having the banner of the Red Cross, but who protects the Red Cross?
It's a question of moral persuasion. And we have no way, really, to protect ourselves. If anyone wants to come in with a machete, panga, or a gun into the hospital and attack us, there's not much we can really do about it.
Did that happen while you were there?
Not in Burundi, no. As I said, in Burundi, people did respect the symbol. And we used Radio Burundi on a number of occasions, putting out a radio message saying to the people that our cars, ambulances, would be traveling in various parts of the country. Burundi is 96% rural population. 6 million people. The largest city, Bujumbura, is only 300,000. Almost the entire population lives scattered out in the hills. And transportation, getting to the hospital, can be a problem. So we would send out our cars with field delegates and field nurses, and they would, people would come out of the hills and wait by the major roadsides, and they knew that the car would be passing by that day, and they would be transported to the hospital. So people did trust the Red Cross and respected the symbol.
While you were working with the Red Cross in Burundi, there were massacres and counter-massacres. What kinds of medical problems did those massacres present for you?
Well, I've done 14, 15 years of war surgery now, and usually it's been assault rifles, landmines, shelling. In Burundi, it was panga, machete, and spear wounds for the most part. And that's a little bit different. First of all, the mortality rate is very, very high. When there is shelling or shooting, for every 100 people injured, about 20 to 25 die. When you use a machete, a panga, It's face-to-face fighting. It's not at a distance. You use the machete with an overhead blow. And the first blow strikes the head or neck. So if you don't chop the head off immediately, the victim falls to the ground, unconscious, blood spurting. Another one or two blows with the machete, and the person is usually dead. So the mortality rate is probably over 95%. In 1 month, there were an estimated 150,000 killed in Burundi. In Bosnia-Herzegovina, it's taken them 2 years to kill 150,000. But with that number of dead, there are relatively few wounded.
What kind of wounds did you see? Were they machete wounds?
Most were machete wounds, a number of gunshot wounds as well. Some people have weapons. The military has assault rifles. But most of the wounds were machete and spear wounds. And the first couple of weeks, I had to perform 15 or 16 craniotomies, head operations, where the cranium, the skull, had been cleaved and the machete had entered the brain. It's not like a bullet wound. The damage is not as great. However, the machete is used to cut trees and grass and what have you, and there's a great deal of organic material along the blade. So it's not a clean, lacerated wound. It is a dirty wound. There is some crushing of the tissues. And because of the organic material that is driven into the tissues, infection is a very big problem. Another problem was simply the lack of mobility of people. People were hiding out of fear in the hills for weeks on end. And we received a number of people who had been wounded 4 or 5 weeks previously, and it was only once things had stabilized somewhat that they managed to finally make it to the hospital.
So you saw a lot of very infected wounds?
Yes.
How do you treat an old wound that has been long infected?
The most important problem that you usually face is the general condition of the patient. They've not been eating well. They're anemic. The sepsis itself causes what we call a catabolism. There was a breakdown of the tissues of the body, so the patient has lost a great deal of weight. And very often, what that patient needs is simply to eat well, blood transfusion, rest, antibiotics, and after a few days, you then operate. Once the general condition of the patient is fit enough to withstand the operation, you then operate in order to cut out damaged tissue, dead bone. But it's the general condition of the patient that is the limiting factor.
Did you have enough antibiotics to treat the people that you saw?
Yes. Antibiotics was sufficient, and the World Food Program was distributing food to the hospital, which we were there able to give to the patients free of charge. Blood, however, is a problem. As in most third world countries, people do not understand the necessity of giving blood, and that for the donor, giving blood has no real negative connotations. People believe that, well, if I give my blood, then I'm giving part of my life. Now, it is a gift of life. The point is that your body reconstitutes the blood. That is an abstract concept. And you tell people, don't worry, in 3 months, in 90 days, this 350 milliliters of blood, your body will have replaced it. That's an abstract concept, and many people do not understand that.
Now, let's get back to the cranium surgery that you had to perform when people were macheted in the head. That sounds to me, knowing nothing, it sounds to me like it would be a pretty high-tech procedure because it involved the brain. I'm sure you didn't have a whole lot of high-tech equipment in your hospital.
Well, we certainly did not have a CAT scan, and you don't need particle CAT scans in order to perform most war surgery. As a matter of fact, most war surgery can be performed even without ordinary x-rays. It's not like a car accident, you see, where you have a broken leg or a fracture of the skull, and it's closed. These are war wounds, so there's a bullet or a machete or what have you that has entered. There is a hole there. And it's very, very easy to inspect for the fracture site. You put on some sterile gloves and you put your fingers in the hole. So you know what sort of fracture there is. You can feel and see where the wound has occurred. It is possible, by applying good scientific concepts and practice, to do relatively good war surgery. trauma surgery without having a great deal of high technology and sophisticated equipment available.
What did you do to get the hospital into shape while you were in Burundi?
The first thing was to clean it. It was a missionary hospital, but these particular missionaries did not understand that cleanliness is close to godliness, and the place was really a pigsty. And it took a great deal of effort in the beginning, gathering together people, some of the neighbors of around the hospital, employing them, and simply a question of soap and water.
So the people who ran the hospital didn't understand the connection between filth and infection?
Well, I think they did. The point is they didn't really go to much effort to clean it. And unfortunately, these missionaries were very, very mercenary. The only thing that really interested them was money, and we had a number of problems with them. They went behind my back and charged money to some patients that I had operated.
Wow.
And unfortunately, that happened to be the case. But all of my anti-clerical reflexes were simply, and prejudices were simply reinforced by this experience.
What was one of your most difficult moments in Burundi while you were running the Red Cross Hospital?
The most difficult moment probably came when I had to deal administratively with some of the personnel, and this is part of the protection function.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of the cleaners in the hospital threatened one of the midwives quite simply because she was from the other community. And this woman who had spent 2-3 months in the hospital through the massacres and counter-massacres, etc., had never left, then panicked and got up and wanted to run away. And I had to sit down with the fellows and make them understand that this sort of behavior was unacceptable, that I could not protect them from the other community if I could not protect this midwife from them. And therefore, it's a question of simply explaining and trying to make people understand.
While explaining, did you threaten a little bit too?
Well, I told them, look, if you want to hit people of the other community and kill them and so forth, well, fine, you're free. It's your society, but you do it outside the hospital. You don't do it in the hospital. You have to make a choice. I'm not telling you not to fight. It's your society, and you're going to have to solve your own problems. But if you want to fight, you can't work in the hospital. You cannot get a Red Cross salary. If you do that, then I cannot protect you. I cannot protect your family members. I cannot protect the patients and other personnel who are from your community. So you have to make a choice.
You spent 2 months in Burundi, which I believe for you is a pretty short stay in another country. Why was it that short?
Largely because the functions of protection had been accomplished at that point, and the situation had stabilized, and there were no longer any wounded left. As I said, the only continuing conflict occurred in the capital city. And in the capital city, there are sufficient hospitals and other doctors and so forth. So the Red Cross at that point does not simply stay on. We pull out our surgical teams and so forth, and we see what else is necessary in the country. Now it's a question of distributing agricultural tools and seeds to the population so that they can profit from the end of the rainy season, so that in 2 months' time there will not be a famine with hundreds of thousands of people starving to death. So now it's a question of relief work. The medical work has been accomplished. And as I said, protection has been established. People do respect the hospitals now. And therefore, that part of our role is terminated and we pull out.
Were you glad to leave?
Glad is a difficult word. My life is a series of departures. And when one works in such a situation, arriving somewhere is always sad because you arrive in the midst of war and suffering and death. Leaving is a mix because you're happy. There's no longer any killing. the wounded have been taken care of. People are well. You are sad because you make friends. And I'm lucky. I have a Canadian passport. I can get out. I can come back to the comforts of North America. But friends, colleagues, people that you work with are not so lucky as to benefit from a Canadian passport. And they remain in a society that is still fractured, that is still suffering, that has great psychological trauma that have to be overcome and dealt with. So leaving is always a mix.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Chris Yanu. He's one of the world's most respected war surgeons, and he spent the past year working for the Red Cross in Burundi and in Afghanistan. Dr. Yanu is also the author of a memoir called Besieged. That's about the time that he spent as the only surgeon in the Shatila refugee camp in West Beirut. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with war surgeon Dr. Chris Yanu, who spent most of the past year in Afghanistan and in Burundi working for the Red Cross as a war surgeon. I imagine you're waiting for reassignment now. You're waiting for the Red Cross to reassign you to another country.
Well, for the moment, I'm relaxing a bit, and I have to sort of step back and manage myself.
What happens if you don't do that?
Oh, well, I mean, I've already been through what one would call a burnout, one depression, after my 8 years in Lebanon, and especially after the 2.5 years that I spent in the Palestinian refugee camp of Shatila. Mm. And it's taxing, and emotionally it's draining. And you do build up defense mechanisms so that you, as any doctor, any surgeon does, so that you can face death and suffering and yet continue to work. Nonetheless, you have to be able to step back. You have to be able to take a certain distance in order to replenish yourself. But for 2 or 3 months, I'll take some time off, and then we'll see what happens next.
Would part of you like to go to Bosnia?
Yes, of course. When I read accounts of what has been happening there over the last 2 years, I mean, it's what I knew in Lebanon. It's what I knew the siege of Shatila, where you're cut off from the world and you have to depend on your own means, and people invent and improvise and they resist and they maintain their dignity. Also, I mean, I was born and brought up in Toronto, Canada, but I'm of Greek Macedonian origin, and I know the Balkans very, very well, and I know the passions, hatreds, chauvinism, even of my own family. And I also know the richness that also exists in the Balkans. I think the greatest victim, what has been happening in Bosnia-Herzegovina over the last 2 years, is the symbol of Sarajevo as a tolerant, multicultural, multi-ethnic, cosmopolitan city. And this is not multiculturalism as a litany of hyphenated ghettos. No, this is true coexistence, tolerant society, where there are Christians, Orthodox and Catholic, there are Muslims, there are Jews, there are Albanians, Greeks, Armenians, as well as Slavs, and the totality is greater than the sum of its parts.
Would there be any chance of the Red Cross sending you to Bosnia?
There are hundreds of Red Cross delegates there, but not surgical teams.
Why not?
There are more than enough Yugoslav surgeons and nurses, and they certainly don't need somebody else coming from outside. The Red Cross does have delegates. We provide medicines and other aid and what have you, and visiting prisoners' detention, trying to get prisoner exchanges, Red Cross messages, families that are separated, and want to contact relatives, etc. It's something like a million Red Cross messages a month. It's the equivalent of a whole postal system. And it's, for many people, the only way that they can contact relatives and loved ones, or even know whether they're still alive or not. So there's a great deal of activity that the Red Cross does, but not surgery. I mean, speaking not as a Red Cross person, but speaking quite simply as an individual, I am appalled at what has happened and what is still happening in Bosnia-Herzegovina the last 2 years. I am appalled by Western reaction. Said, in Burundi, it's not ethnic cleansing in the ideological sense. I mean, in Bosnia-Herzegovina, we have seen ethnic cleansing, ideological. I am appalled because 50 years after the Jewish genocide, the Holocaust, the West, the liberal democracies, have simply sat back and watched it happen. And all of the arguments have been why it would be difficult to intervene and how it would be dangerous and how, why should our boys die to stop Serbs and Croats killing each other? There's no oil in Bosnia-Herzegovina. That's one problem. Because we got 500,000 soldiers into the Gulf in a matter of only a couple of months. And if 500,000 soldiers had been mobilized 2 years ago, 3 years ago, then the carnage of ex-Yugoslavia could have been prevented. Telling the people of Yugoslavia, telling the radical nationalists of all boards, these are the rules of the game. If you want to be part of Europe of the 21st century, human rights, the rights of minorities, you do not change borders through the use of force. But the West is in political paralysis, moral bankruptcy, intellectual laxity.
I should say that we were recording this in the morning before knowing the outcome of the NATO meeting held today. Do you feel that your work as a war surgeon constantly exposes you to the most insane parts of the human condition, the parts of the human condition that carry out massacres and ethnic cleansing and, you know, just the most awful things?
Well, that's insane, but so is wife abuse, so is homelessness. You don't have to go to war zones in order to see war. There are certain areas of the United States that would be described as war zones. And certainly there's a great deal of violence that we call domestic violence. You don't need a Kalashnikov to beat your wife. And yes, I am exposed. But I think, for me, what is important is to keep my mind open to whatever is happening around me, to be receptive, to understand that, I mean, Sarajevo, Kabul, Bujumbura are not the only sources of violence in this world. But I have to be aware of all of the other violences that are also occurring. And as an individual, as a citizen who believes in human rights and human dignity, I have to be attuned to every injustice and do what I can in my way to put an end to whatever injustice I see.
I have one last question for you. How is your health, and have you had any serious medical problems during the last year when you've been in Afghanistan and Burundi?
I am in disgustingly good health.
Good for you.
Considering how much I smoke and drink and everything else, I'm in disgustingly good health.
Good, and keep it that way.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for talking with us, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Dr. Chris Janu is a war surgeon with the International Committee of the Red Cross. His memoir, Besieged, A Doctor's Story of Life and Death in Beirut, is published by Interlink. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, tabloid truth. Are the tabloids starting to set the agenda for the mainstream press? There's a new Frontline documentary that follows how the tabloid press and network TV covered the Michael Jackson scandal. We'll talk to the producer of the documentary, Tom Lennon. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews cellist Yo-Yo Ma's new recording of music by American composers, including Bernstein, Ives, and Gershwin. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Israel and the PLO have signed an agreement spelling out the details of Palestinian self-rule in Gaza and the West Bank town of Jericho. Both PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat and Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres signed the agreement at the Egyptian Presidential Palace in Cairo. They shook hands amid loud applause. Details of the agreement have not been released, but it reportedly solves the thorny issue of border crossings into both territories and the pullout of Israeli troops. NATO has agreed to order airstrikes against Bosnian Serbs who are besieging the Bosnian capital. The alliance has told the Serbs they must pull out their weapons from around Sarajevo or face the consequences. But in an apparent effort to head off an attack, the Bosnian Serbs agreed earlier today to do just that. They've also agreed to a ceasefire with the Bosnian government, which is supposed to go into effect tomorrow. The country's biggest postal customers are urging a more than 10% postal rate increase. This would raise the price of a first-class stamp to 32 cents. Arthur Sackler is the managing director of the Mailers Council. He says the country's business community will support an increase in the cost of a stamp. He says it will benefit everyone.
The Postal Service gets some financial breathing room as it contemplates and acts upon its future. Consumers get a 3-cent stamp increase instead of 4 or 5 cents. Business mailers get proportionately the same rate increases. And both consumers and business mailers get a postal system primed to address its future in the best way to serve us all.
The increase would provide the post office with $5 billion more a year. A Senate panel is looking at ways the federal government can cut down on gang-related violence. NPR's Carolyn Clark Kelly reports.
At least 700 cities in the U.S. report problems with gangs. Law enforcement officials say children are entering them as early as age 13, and a growing number of girls are joining gangs. Connecticut Democrat Chris Dodd told a subcommittee on juvenile justice that he's all for spending more on police and prisons, but he also thinks Congress should invest in prevention and make money available to groups like Boys and Girls Clubs.
It costs roughly $500 a year for a good after-school program per child. It costs $25,000 to $30,000 in my state to keep a person locked up each year. It seems to me the modest investment in trying to come up with some alternative ideas for these young people is well worth making.
Supporters of both prevention and stepped-up punishment hope to see their measures included in the final version of the crime bill. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
President Clinton has released his new anti-drug program. It's worth more than $13 billion and puts more money into treatment and drug abuse prevention. On Wall Street, stock prices closed with a big gain today. The Dow rose more than 25 points to end at 3,931. Advances topped declines by a margin of 3-2. This is NPR. The former law firm of First Lady Hillary Clinton is denying a newspaper report that says they shredded papers connected to the Whitewater real estate deal. The Rose Law Firm says allegations printed in the Washington Times newspaper are totally false. A special counsel is looking into the Whitewater case. He's to determine if funds from a savings and loan controlled by a friend of the Clintons were wrongly invested in the Whitewater development or into President Clinton's gubernatorial campaigns. The Rose firm's managing partner says the company never had any papers relating to the matter, and there was no shredding of any kind. Japanese Prime Minister Morihiro Hosokawa says trade talks with the United States are stalled. His acknowledgment comes 2 days before a meeting with President Clinton in Washington. NPR's Marjorie Sun reports.
Prime Minister Hosokawa is sending high-level envoys to Washington at the last minute in hopes of a breakthrough in the trade talks before Friday's summit with President Clinton. Foreign Minister Tsutomu Hata is flying to Washington today, a day early, to try to move the trade talks along. The two countries are at loggerheads over how to open Japanese markets, especially in cars and car parts. Yesterday, a special emissary for Hosokawa met with Mr. Clinton and Vice President Al Gore in hopes that the White House might soften its tough trade stance with Japan. The envoy, Akitani Kiyuchi, is said to have asked them to be patient given Hosokawa's political troubles. But the White House was firm in its insistence that it expects substantial progress by Friday's meeting. In Tokyo, I'm Marjorie Sun.
A private real estate group says more Americans can afford to buy a home now than at any time in the last 20 years. The National Association of Realtors says its Housing Affordability Index rose to its highest level since 1973. The group says an average family that earned the median income of $37,500 had more than enough money to buy a home. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Scandals, they've been all over the mainstream media. Tanya Harding, the Menendez brothers, the Bobbitts, Michael Jackson. A new documentary called Tabloid Truth suggests that the tabloid press is starting to set the agenda for some stories in the mainstream media. But when getting the scoop on a scandal, the mainstream press has trouble keeping up with the tabloids. Tabloid Truth is about the Michael Jackson scandal, but it's not about did he or didn't he. It's about how the story was covered by the tabloid print press like the National Enquirer, tabloid TV like Hard Copy and A Current Affair, and network TV news. The documentary was produced for the PBS Frontline series by my guest Tom Lennon. It will be shown on most PBS stations next Tuesday night. I asked Lennon what stories made him think that the mainstream press was starting to take its cues from the tabloids.
I was watching television a long time ago, a couple of years ago, and it was the day of the William Kennedy Smith verdict, and the networks were going live. And the network guys were throwing the questions out to their guys in the field, saying, okay, the verdict is out. What are the jurors saying? And I was watching, and one of the guys in the field said, well, Dan, I think it was Dan, to be honest with you, I don't have any idea because CBS policy is such that we can't pay jurors, and therefore none of them are talking to me. And it was just one of those moments where, you know, the jaw drops and you realize, oh my God, this, you know, we've had a sea change in media in the last few years, an absolute sea change. And no one had ever, it seemed to me, really tried to go out and get that on film. And that was a long time ago, and then there were other things going on, and it was hard to schedule because you really are hostage to the event. You're waiting for the right event to happen. Mike Tyson came and went. That had sort of tempted me, but I was tied up with something else. And then finally, we had sort of gotten the whole idea approved. We were a go, and about 3 or 4 days later, the police raid happened on Jackson, and it was clear that that was the one to leap on. I mean, you, in a sense, we were being as calculating as anyone else in the media, which is to say that the Jackson story had celebrity, it had sex, it had crime, it even had children and the sort of twist of Jackson's involvement with children. And so you knew that this was going to bring everybody out in their full glory, and that we couldn't afford, if we wanted to try to get at what are media people doing, what is the state of media, that this was one we couldn't afford to let go, so we jumped on it.
So you found out how the story actually broke. How did the Michael Jackson story break?
It started as an anonymous call. Nobody to this day knows the tipster who did it, nor the motivations for doing it. But there's a guy out in L.A. who has a history, an independent producer, reporter, who runs a tiny little production shop out of his own house in the Valley. And one dead quiet on a Sunday morning, he gets a call. The person doesn't identify themselves, says there's a raid that's gone down. And the guy's obviously trying to disguise his voice. And Neverland and this independent producer, reporter, Don Ray, he's a Latin music fan. He didn't know what, he said, what, Peter Pan got searched? And the guy leads him through, finally basically spells it out that it's Jackson. And the guy, the reporter says, well, I'm going to have to confirm this. The only possible way he had of confirming it was by calling locksmiths at random, because he'd understood that there had been a locksmith who had been there in Neverland with the cops, helping the people, helping the cops do their search. He started calling locksmiths at random. Boom, he hit one. One said, yeah, I was in Neverland yesterday, and that was there it all began.
You report on a lot of the tabloids on TV and print tabloids that paid their sources to get the stories on Michael Jackson. Who are some of the sources that got paid on the Jackson story?
Well, first of all, there are dozens and dozens of sources who got paid that I know nothing about.
Mm-hmm.
You had information flowing out with stunning speed and efficiency in the early days after the story broke. And, you know, whether that's cop sources, whether that's court sources, whether that's employees, whether it's secretaries inside lawyers' offices, whether it's, I mean, you got to understand that the strands, the penetration level is just immense. But then after about 3 days, people don't realize, but in 3 days, most of the basic information on the Jackson scandal was out, which is to say, the kid, the nature of the kid's complaints, the custody battle between the father and the mom that was at one point fueling the controversy and so forth. So now what do? You see, because now the beast is awakened, right? The media beast is in full roar. In fact, it's just gaining stride, and there's not a hell of a lot more to talk about. So that's the point where then you have, you know, 50, 100 cameras, right? And you have many, many more print people all milling around. And it creates an opportunity for people to step in with their own agendas.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom Lennon, and he's the producer of a new Frontline documentary called Tabloid Truth, The Michael Jackson Scandal. And for this story, they followed the press that followed the Michael Jackson story. It'll be broadcast February 15th on most PBS stations. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Tom Lennon, the producer of a Frontline documentary called Tabloid Truth, The Michael Jackson Scandal. One of the more fascinating details in your documentary is that the cops are really getting angry, because cops are often losing out to the tabloids. When somebody has information, they'd prefer to get paid for it, so they'll go to a tabloid that's going to pay them as opposed to just giving the information to the cops.
Well, I mean, you know, if you're working on a modest salary, and you have some information, and you can take it to the cops and make zip, or you can take it to a tabloid and possibly make, you know, six figures. Some people are going to choose one, some people are going to choose the other route. So it's a problem for the cops, absolutely. You know, one of the interesting things about tabloid truth, which is Richard Ben Kramer's phrase, and a great one it is that it gets very wiggy. You start being unsure about almost everything. You know, if I have a passing acquaintance with Jackson, and I say that, you know, I used to see him and I always thought his behavior was weird with kids. Well, that's, you know, in the free market of tabloid stories, that's worth a zip, right? If, on the other hand, I saw the hand go somewhere where the hand didn't belong, that could be worth $100,000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, how is this starting to affect the mainstream press that wants the sources too,
right,
but many
right.
of the sources would rather get some money for their information?
Yeah. Terry, I worked in network television for a hell of a long time, almost 10 years.
At ABC?
Yeah. Now, let's say I'm out there and I'm one of their guys in their LA bureau, and I get a call in the middle of the night and says, you know, Jackson's been raided and... you know, go get it, right? And let's say I'm up against, which I would be, up against the National Enquirer, who's going to win? I mean, you got 20 reporters, you got open checkbooks, you got detectives, you got paid sources, versus three or four hardworking guys in the LA bureau of a given network. I mean, it's just, it barely requires being answered, right? And so then that's extremely frustrating. You see, so then that now the morning shows are calling and they're saying, you know, how come I'm reading all this stuff in, how come I'm getting my information from hard copy? How come we have to interview Diane Diamond? How come we have to bring her into the CBS studio and interview her?
In the Michael Jackson story, do you think network TV covered the story in a way that they wouldn't have had it broken 10 years ago?
Look, there's another reason why mainstream guys get beaten by the tabloids, in addition to all the other reasons I mentioned. And that's for one of the most appealing of reasons, which is that the mainstream guys are very ambivalent about the work.
Mm-hmm. About this kind of story.
This kind of story, you see. And restrained as they are by ethical considerations, by questions of taste,
mm-hmm.
By their own sense of, you know, how they feel about their own work, not to mention the fact that they're not going to pay. So that the fact that they get beat by the tabloids in a lot of ways, I think, speaks well of the networks. I mean, I don't think it's an easy hit. So that you have to factor that in.
One of the points of your show is that the mainstream media is starting to become just a little bit more like the tabloid press and the kinds of stories they follow. Do you think that network TV is feeling a little bit pressured to consider paying interviewees or paying sources? Did you get a sense of that at all?
The ethical restraints on the one hand are very, very clear and unambiguous, and networks paid the price many times getting to a story and not being able to compete, and whether happily or unhappily, absolutely paid that price and did not cough up money. There can be other ways. I think that as the pressures mount, you may start to find backdoor. I mean, there aren't any. The lines are really hard to draw, Terry. Because let's say that somebody has some incriminating photos and a story to tell. Right now, you will never have a mainstream organization saying joining in that auction where it's $50,000, $60,000. Well, I'll go up to $75,000 for someone to go on camera. Absolutely, will not happen. Well, but now there's the videotape and there's the stills, and that's a perfectly legitimate licensing thing. I do it all the time on documentaries. I do a purchase the rights to use a photograph, and maybe that can be a backdoor way to make some sort of payment that is defensible. But I would think that if there's ever going to be leakage in terms of the checkbook journalism stuff, it would be in the purchase of materials, because there, it's really not a clear line. It's a question of degree. It's a question of how much you're paying.
When you were covering the press coverage of the Michael Jackson story, was it hard to get the people from the tabloids to talk with you openly about what they were doing and who they were willing to buy stories from?
It was intermittently, but on the whole, I was stunned by the access and the openness that we were greeted with. You know, the tabloid guys have taken their share of knocks, and they figure that they can probably only go up from here. That's number one. And number two, they feel their complaint is that they're doing a lot of things that a lot of other people are doing. And so they had a message they wanted to get across, and they were, you know, in a way steamed at this hard line that is drawn between them and the respectable press. And they've got half a point. And so they, in a sense, were eager to talk to us. Yes, protective of sources. Yes, protective of their habits sometimes, but sometimes not. I mean, we're in the offices with Steve Dunleavy, who's a great. I mean, the other thing is when you have a new phenomenon like that, a sort of which I think it's really the last 5 or 6 years that it's ballooned, and it's been sort of a gold rush. You get these like larger than life characters. I mean, Steve Dunleavy, what made me think of it is Steve Dunleavy coming roaring out of his office going, "Where are those bloody checks? I lost the bloody checks." He had two checks in his jacket pocket when he was going out to do a story. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out the purpose of carrying those checks around. And he knew perfectly well that we were there. And he's roaring, looking for his checks. It's what you see is what you get. And these guys are proud of their method. And I'll tell you something else, Terry. Their methods are very different from my methods. There's a lot about what they do that makes me very squeamish, and Richard and I wrote about that in the show. But they're good. They are really efficient at what they do.
You used to work for ABC Television.
Right.
Do you think that journalistic standards have changed since you were at Network TV?
I think there's a kind of titanic struggle, is my sense. I know that ABC, for example, last year held a whole series of ethical seminars with all of their different magazine shows to remind people about what you can and cannot do. And I think the fact that they felt the need to do that is eloquent about both the incredible power of this undertow, you see, that's pulling them. I mean, they've got to compete. And they've got to compete. It's like they've got to compete with one hand behind their back, right?
Yeah.
So there, you know, it's not that they're just rushing to imitate tabloid. There's a fierce kind of ambivalence about both wanting to compete, wanting to get the audience, loving it. Listen, when they did Lorena Bobbitt on 2020, their audience went through the roof. So of course they're going to go more tabloid, but at the same time they're profoundly ambivalent about it, fighting it at the same time.
Well, now that you've completed the documentary Tabloid Truth, does everybody really want to know what you know about the inside scoop of whether Michael Jackson really did it or not? Is that what everybody really wants to know from you?
That was just relentless while we were making it. We'd say, well, we're doing this piece. We're going behind the scenes. You see, we're going the other way. We're not filming the scandal. We're filming the people filming the scandal. And, you know, your friend's eyes would sort of glaze over and they go, oh, that sounds really great. So, did you do it?
Tom Lennon is the producer of the documentary Tabloid Truth. It will be shown on the Frontline series next Tuesday night on most PBS stations. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. We'll have the latest on the siege of Sarajevo and the NATO consideration of this matter, the practicality of issuing an ultimatum to the Bosnian Serbs around Sarajevo, 10 days to pull their guns back. We'll go to the National Zoo in Washington, D.C. to see how Kamari is doing. She's a baby elephant born on the 14th of December, the first ever at this zoo. The first hour and a half of her life was a very treacherous time. Robert Siegel helps us remember Raymond Scott, a composer and orchestra leader. He's died. He was also a pioneer in electronic music. And Tom Hanks has been nominated for an Academy Award for his role in Philadelphia. We'll recall one particular scene.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Yo-Yo Ma is best known and best loved for his recordings of the classical cello repertoire, but his latest album is called Made in America, and it's devoted completely to American music. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says it may be Ma's most important recording.
Made in America is a vivid demonstration of Yo-Yo Ma's commitment both to American and contemporary music. The centerpiece is Leon Kirshner's powerful and rhapsodic triptych for violin and cello. This began as a single movement for solo violin. Kirshner then transcribed it as a cello solo for Yo-Yo Ma, called, not surprisingly, for solo cello. Ma scheduled it for a recital at Tanglewood in 1988 on the same program with a separate Kirshner piece, the two-movement duo for violin and cello. Kirshner is a distinguished composer, conductor, and virtuoso pianist. He came to teach at Harvard in 1961 and became the first music professor there to offer a course in performance. Ma was one of his prize students. Kirshner composed this duo for Ma and another former student, one of Ma's oldest friends and partners, the violinist Lin Chang. Kirshner immediately decided to combine the two separate pieces into a single three-movement work that is now about 20 minutes long. This recording, with the original collaborators, makes a wonderful birthday tribute to their teacher, who just turned 75. The solo first movement is one of Ma's most deeply felt recorded performances, and the transition from solo to duet is one of the most exquisite and chilling moments in contemporary chamber music. Has performed and recorded with players and conductors who are not his artistic equals, but this disc is an exception. There's not only Lin Chang, but also the adventurous pianist Jeffrey Kahane, who joins Ma in Ma's own transcription of Leonard Bernstein's Clarinet Sonata, and in a jazzy, freewheeling performance of Ma's cello transcription of Yasha Heifetz's violin arrangement of George Gershwin's Three Preludes. The album ends with the vigorous and invigorating teamwork of Ma, violinist Ronan Lefkowitz, and pianist Gilbert Kalish in a no-holds-barred rendition of one of the greatest of all American chamber works, Charles Ives's astounding Trio. Ives worked on it for 7 years, from 1904 to 1911. It almost sounds as if it were written last week.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Yo-Yo Ma's new recording, Made in America. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Devin Reif and Ann Neville are our interns. Our program is directed by Roberta Shirock. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.